everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, we're going to examine the biology of wonder and how we can mend our alienation and broken relationship with nature, within ourselves, and with each other. Joining me from Berlin, Germany, by Skype, is Dr. Andreas Weber, but that is pronounced in German, Weber. He is a biologist, a philosopher, a poet, an author. He is teaching at the university in Lundberg, Germany, and at the Berlin University of the Arts. He's been called a philosopher for the Anthropocene. His work is in the tradition of the great Chilean neuroscientist and philosopher Francisco Varela, who he worked with and who pioneered the concept of the theory that biological organisms and communities are self-organizing, as well as the work of Rupert Sheldrake, who we had on this program not long ago. Andreas's work has focused on our humanitarian need to overcome our mechanistic interpretation of life and to embrace a new ecological understanding in order to engage all of our human senses. His writings have appeared in National Geographic, Geo, and other major publications. He's written several books, and including The Biology of Wonder, and more recently this month, Matter and Desire, an Erotic Ecology, which has been recognized as being in the tradition of Rachel Carson and the great American nature poet John Muir. And his website is biologyofwonder.org. Nice to have you with us today, Andreas.
Hi, Gary.
One of the greatest threats, in my opinion at least, that humanity faces today is not just climate change. It's the disruption of our Earth's ecosystems, our economy, then is relying upon that ecosystem being forever there and abundant, unlimited, which it is not. And hence, that will lead to economic collapse. The dangers we witness to ourselves and our way of living in the modern world due to climate change and the loss of natural resources are probably nature's normal response to the greater threat due to our deterministic, rationalist, and reductionist scientific worldview that has decided in its self-proclaimed omnipotence that all of nature is mechanical. Now, I find this disturbing, and I'm going to ask you in a moment to explore this in depth. Why? Because in this perspective, based upon capitalism and laissez-faire, neocolonialism, globalism, whatever you wish to call it, it's about one small group of people control through their power of monopoly and creation of debt to create a pool of resources in every country that has anything of value that can be commodified and sold, as if there is no limit to this. And the people who are engineering this, the economic engineers, the people behind the scenes who support that, the technocrats, never seem to look ahead to say, what is the likely outcome of this constant exploitation of nature? And as a result, we now have a world that is polluted, and they have decided in their minds that nature is little more than a machine. And aside from humans, all other forms of matter and life on this planet are absent any consciousness. So if we adapt this position, which all of Wall Street, all of Washington, D.C., the entire 400,000 contractors working within the Washington Consensus, the German government, the Italian government, the Spanish, less so the Spanish government, very much so the English government and the French government, the major governments, along with the Russian government and the Chinese government, all have a similar disposition. And so what is happening is that we're only looking at technological and industrial progress and solutions. We do not even consider the relevance of humans today, with IT taking over, with the robotics taking over, with new forms of artificial intelligence taking over, then the human beings, unless you're at a very powerful position, you're redundant. You're obsolete. You no longer have any value. And then there is no fundamental or underlying purpose behind nature aside from serving humanity's needs so that we can continue to procreate and find ease and comfort. And we find this attitude especially strong in the biological sciences, particularly medicine and genetics, that I'm ashamed of, absolutely ashamed of. And I'm a scientist. I'm a PhD in human nutrition and public health science, a professor, a research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology, working, have over 143 original scientific discoveries myself. So coming from inside that institution, I can tell you, it has gone mad. It is so selfish, so self-absorbed, so monotheistic, and it's looking, it doesn't give a damn, a twit, about what happens as long as they make money, they get funding, they get recognized, and they're honored. The fact that they can destroy nature, destroy human beings, and not solve any problems, they simply want to be rewarded today for their efforts and their connections. They never look up to say, did our new invention hurt anyone? Did deforestation actually impact nature? Did feeding genetically engineered foods hurt anyone? Did this medicine actually cause more problems than it resolved? We don't care about the outcome. That is irrelevant. Whether you succeed or failed is irrelevant, because when you're in power, you're never held accountable for results, only maintaining this kind of human hubris that, well, look what we built and look what we sustain. So in conclusion, my opinion, this mechanistic cynicism is just another religion. It's another cult, but a perverted religion built upon the greed of humans at all levels. And this has contributed what I believe you refer to as our alienation and separation, not only from nature and the natural world, but also from each other and our communities. And no other species cannibalizes itself, especially on a path towards suicide and extinction, as do we humans. And now science would have us believe that humans are little more than machines, that consciousness is only the dance of neurons and neurochemical reactions. So as a biologist, I would ask you to begin there and further elaborate and critique this deterministic reductionist worldview that has hijacked our deeper philosophies and ethics and spiritualities. So how does this mechanistic view bring humanity as a species to the point where we are sick, we are out of balance, we are maladaptive, not just physically, nor mentally, but spiritually? Take your time. The forum is yours.
Okay. Thanks, Gary. I'm also a biologist, as you know, so I also have this inside view of starting to learn how a discipline works, and to feel that it just doesn't bring me where I felt I would like to go when I decided that I wanted to become a biologist. So I share what you say about this tendency to objectify and separate. And I have this vivid recollection of one moment in an undergraduate course when it was dealing with insect anatomy, and the tutor had a jar with hundreds of flies which were alive at that moment, and then he put some poison into it to kill them and to hand them out to us students so that we could observe them and we could cut them open and draw them. And so it was all very honest in the sense of let's teach the students how life as a mechanism works, but it was also about let's teach the students how life as a surface works, and not as something which you intrinsically and emotionally connect to. And I remember that all of us had this sudden shiver and sudden rebellion and even rejection of it. Was like we didn't rebel. It was not a rebellion. So in the end, everybody was doing what he was or she was supposed to do. But I remember there was this wave of of uneasiness going through the whole class. Like, this is not the way we can deal with life in a way. And so, I mean, this I tell this just to connect to what you said about the experience of a scientist and knowing, feeling what science is doing, and feeling with certainty that it is in a very strong sense not satisfying our needs as a being who is interested in life, in connecting with life, and in understanding other life, and who has the feeling, the yearning to connect to life because he or she is alive as well. And that's actually one of my main points, I would say, that our culture, and already for a very long time, I would say our Western culture, has made a problem out of what is the most evident experience for every being, namely to be alive, and to be alive as a body, a physical body, but at the same time as an inwardness, as a feeling, as a self, as a concern, which is always mediated and related to this body. So that's the basic feeling of being alive. Being alive is being flesh and desire, and that's something you are born with, or you even have this before you're born. You have this in the womb. It doesn't even start with you. It comes to you when the two cells, the sperm and the egg, meet. And for some reason our worldview has started to somehow question the security of this primary feeling of being alive as a feeling body, as a feeling and vulnerable body. And in a sense that to be alive has become the main, let's say, the main philosophical problem. And instead of starting with a certainty that we are always feeling entities able to be in connection, our culture for a very long time has substituted the idea of a mechanical causality or rational causality, or the idea of a machine, which is totally different. And from whose standpoint the idea of being alive becomes a problem. And then a lot of great philosophers have worked from the standpoint that the thing we need to explain, the strange thing and the enigmatic thing we cannot understand, is life, is to be alive, is actually the most evident and the most primary experience which we all have. So in a way, our culture has just put the whole thing on its head. So in a way, the most normal experiences have become the most enigmatic ones, and we have started to see our world as a dead cosmos. Or I tend to say that we are following an ideology of death, as we always try to explain that which we are and which we have by means of parts which are not alive in themselves, and we are kind of obsessed with death. Only that we do not really know this, because it's the same obsession that leads us to believe in progress and to believe in efficiency and to believe in the common denominator of mainstream biology and neoliberalism, that there is a drive towards refinement and towards more success and to win by becoming better than the competitor. And so to my eyes, we are for at least the last 2,000 years, we humans have become blinded to, we are blinding ourselves to what is most evident as an experience, and to what all babies are born with, and to what all other living beings, animals and mushrooms and plants and bacteria are also being born with. That's the feeling to be alive. And this is for us something problematic and secondary, and we have substituted this with this idea that we can control a mechanical process of optimization. And so it's, to my eyes, it's very much possible that we are, as a civilization, we are totally heading in the wrong direction, and we are actually not understanding what our existence is all about. So we're telling ourselves stories which are not about what is really important and what is really happening. We are kind of blinding ourselves against what there is, and this leads to pathological outcomes, as always happens if you're blinding yourself against what truly is the fact, or what truly matters, or what truly is your reality. And to my eyes, this leads to this strange and often not very truly prominent, but it's like in the background, there's this strange feeling of we are kind of somehow wrong, even if in personal lives we prosper, but there's still a weird kind of detachment from truly feeling connected to what truly counts. And just today I had a conversation with an eminent biologist, and we were exchanging emails about basically the question, what is there anything more to the molecular organization of life than just molecules, or is there another side of what is molecules which we can describe in a way which includes interiority and self and concern? And I understood again, because I have had this experience many times, that if you are a trained biologist, and if you have lived in this tradition, and if you have lived in this world of academia, then you are, even if you feel that something in the mainstream worldview is wrong, it is so difficult to step out of this and to say, I know, because I am a living being with feelings and with flesh, I know what life in connection is about, and I allow myself to overcome this paradigm of only dead matter. It's so difficult for our leading culture to change the view, because the peer groups are pressuring you into a certain direction, and this, just to conclude what I'm saying, this is coming close to what you said in your introduction, when you were getting from talking about a new kind of biology which is including feeling and which is including interiority into a picture of organism, to our current socio-economic situation, we do have a pressure in this world which is directed towards making us believe that we are only machines which need to function. And this pressure isn't only there because we somehow erroneously have run into this dead-end street and we just can't get out. It's also a pressure which is exerted by certain groups who have an interest in, let's say, in colonializing life, in enclosing life, to use it for very particular, special, private, monetary, personal prosperity interest. So it's not only a metaphysical disaster or dilemma or maybe a metaphysical a huge metaphysical historical error, but it's also working to the favor of certain people for whom it is offering an advantage to deal with the world in order of separating separating things from humans and separating nature from humans and spirit from matter and so on. So there's also some pressure and a lot of pressure which is playing into the hands of few people, and we always need to keep in mind this.
I appreciate your overview, Andreas. I'm going to share some extemporaneous thoughts. If you find any rationale in addressing them in any particular order, please do.
Yeah.
But I believe at this moment, with all the crisis that we are emerged in, that what is missing in these glaring weak links on the spiritual level, by focusing all on the mechanistic worldview, that we must introduce the sensate world that is the focus of how we can see all organisms of every kind as subjects rather than mechanical objects, and the world of feelings, of passion, of bewilderment, of sensual values, of exchanging energies that contradicts this mechanistic view. And I believe that by putting more attention on our feelings and sensate nature in order to be more constructively confronting the ecological and environmental challenges, that we can make a difference. Now, that's just an abstract concept, but here's what I'm seeing today. So I want to ground our conversation right now in something that is not esoteric and not abstract, something very real. But to do so, if you indulge me for a few moments, I'm going to pull together things from the past into our current consciousness that everyone's aware of, but I don't believe we ever step back far enough to honestly examine something without first being either critical of it or judging it. In other words, that moment when, like the Buddha, we can detach, we can look at it for what it is, and simply define its existence based upon how we relate to it. Examples. Back when the Occupy Wall Street occurred, there was no media. In fact, I believe I was the first journalist to go down there. I was there on day one. And as I walked around, I went there every day. And later, when it became popular, then other people who craved the media came down, including some famous liberals, suddenly showed up because, oh, gee whiz, you know, if there's a camera, they're there. I know one of them personally, so I know that's his motive. In any case, when I was there, I asked a person, what are you demonstrating against? Big government, corporations, the commodification of all life. I said, fair enough. I'm with you. I support that, and good for you for being here. And I said, and what are you for? We're for the freedom to be responsible. And if our corporations were as responsible as we are as individuals, we wouldn't have this gross disparity between the have and have-nots. Okay, good. I said, again, noble cause, I support you. And I said, and by that time, a whole group had gotten around, and they were, with maybe three or four exceptions, they were all young people. So I said, so is there any contradiction in what you're here to do in your own life? No. I said, okay. And I pulled back my shirt, and I said, my shirt is union made in the USA, as are my pants and socks. I said, and look at my credit card here, and look at my diet. I'm a vegan. I'm only using this as an example. But now, if I'm not mistaken, you're eating McDonald's. You're drinking a Coca-Cola. You've got Tommy Hilfiger clothes, and you got Nike shoes. You've got a Starbucks there. And so if I understand this, can I look at your wallet, please? So a woman gave me her wallet. She had like 9 credit cards, Bank of America and Citigroup. And I said, okay. I said, now, you are against the very thing you're supporting. So if you're against things like cruelty to animals, why are you eating a hamburger? If you're against the pollution of our environment, why are you eating genetically engineered foods? If you're against, and I was very specific, without condemnation, without moralizing, I simply said, do you believe in the rights of women not to be exploited? And I didn't get an answer. I got a self-righteous refrain. Like, what are you, an idiot? You're asking me? And I said, I'm just asking you. Don't personalize. It's just a question. Yes, of course. Who isn't? All the upper, yeah, we're all for it. I said, then please show me where your clothes are made. Most of them were made in Bangladesh. And then I explained that women in Bangladesh make 14 cents an hour. They work 18-hour days. They get home late at night. They have to make their food for their family. They have to do all this before they get a few hours sleep and go back to work. They have the shortest life expectancy of any working force in the world. It's like 34 to 35 years of age. They're treated cruelly at work. And I said, so 900 million garments were made in Bangladesh alone last year. That does not include India or other countries. Shipped to the United States. And they're from high-end to box store varieties. And I said, could you imagine what it would mean if you boycotted them and then said, I'm only going to buy something that is fair trade or fair exchange or union made in the United States, or a country that I know that the laborers are being treated fairly? Would you imagine what would happen to our environment and global warming if you went vegan and bought locally produced legumes and plants and fruits and vegetables, and not have something trucked, a meat, 5,000 miles across America to get to here? You'd be lowering the carbon footprint, lowering nitrogen levels, which are over 20 times more powerful than CO2. You could be helping the environment. And think of the diseases you'd be preventing, heart disease, cancers. And we want to prevent breast cancer, uterine cancer, prostate cancer, lung cancer. And imagine then if we said no to the banks, if we went to credit unions, if we went to fair exchange. And what about the private universities? They all went to private schools. What if we chose to fund public schools and have universal health care? And so then I asked them where they stood on 35 points. And here's what was interesting. On almost all these points, they sided with the corporate liberal community, meaning they were for regime change, they were for the military-industrial complex, they didn't talk about closing 900 military bases, they didn't talk about stopping deforestation in the rainforest to get your hamburger. They had to destroy rainforests that are the lungs of the planet. So when I got into all this, there was just this palpable anger. And then they started yelling at me, you know. And I just listened to them. And I said, so maybe at some point in this movement, and it was the very beginning, you might want to invite some of the people from the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, the back to the earth movement, the animal rights movement, the human rights movement, all these other movements, and people who are in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, who could come and provide you with some additional insights. To that gained nothing but animus and anger. Okay, I was there for about 12 days. I was there in Washington, D.C. I was there in Philadelphia. I went around the country there in Naples, Florida. I wanted to see what they represented, so it wasn't just an isolated situation. Young people moralizing, but then I started to see there was a substantial hypocrisy or a lack of maturity. And I wrote at the time an article, isn't it time that someone opened the door and allowed some elders in who may provide some wisdom? But that was rejected. Everything that could have helped the movement rejected, and as a result, ultimately it died out. We got a few little typical slogans from it, but nothing fundamentally changed. Now, that's one point, and I'll show how that ties in. Now let's come today to where you have avowed racists, avowed anti-Semites, avowed hate mongers, a relatively small group, in and of themselves, they're not going to topple the government, they're not going to change anything. And they're met now with people dressed in black who are there to commit violence, anarchy. And I'm asking today, would Martin Luther King have approached creating a forum to show that how you address racism, how you address bigotry, how you address big government, how you address war, how you address violence at the corporate level, the federal level, the state level, militarization of the police, how do you address these from a nonviolent but progressive perspective? I played a clip of him, and it's as if we need now more than ever the great minds of the past and present who are never allowed on any forum to come forward and share some different perspectives, because the people who have hijacked the limelight are neither policymakers nor opinion leaders. These are exhibitionists and the extremists. And suddenly what we're not paying attention to, we're not paying attention to what really caused the storm that is the worst storm, rainstorm in American history. We're not looking at why people are going bankrupt or dying from the wrong medications. We're not looking at inequality. We're not looking at the de-ghettoization of our society. We're not looking at going to a plant-based diet. We're not looking at how to prevent disease. We're not looking at the curriculum, let alone how it's taught in school. All the important issues, not one of them, not one single important issue is being addressed today, because we're all over here watching this spectacle play out as if somehow this is essential to our well-being, this fight, like the Bloods and the Crips, as if there's legitimacy in that fight. There is not. Now, finally, look today. Was there any conversation in any of the media, progressive or liberal or conservative, about what happened to all the barrier islands that were around Galveston and Houston that were removed so developers could exploit more of the good views that slow down the impact of rain and all the mangrove forest? What happened to the overexploitation of a community like Houston, the fourth largest city, where no one thought what would happen on a flat land at sea level with a clay base that any water is not going to dissipate? Why was there no planning for this type of eventuality? All those tall skyscrapers, million-dollar apartments, the generators are in the basement, so they're all without water, without electricity. Why didn't anyone ask, are we meant to be in a non-sustainable environment that is dry as a bone, getting hotter, with nothing's going to be able to grow here, and we're all vulnerable to the next hurricane? Was there any discussion of what happened to the gentrification of an area where all you did is push the poor people out and exploit whatever natural resources you had? Did anyone talk about the billions, with a B, billions of gallons of oil and gas that are stored in the largest refinery terminals in the world, right there in the Houston area, that are now flooding so that oil and gas is going to go into the water, into the soil, into the rivers, and you're not going to get that out? Not only is it going to be toxic to grow anything, but it's going to go into the what remaining aquifer system you have and permanently pollute it. No discussion. And with all the money, with all the success, with all the wealth, with all the billionaires, why wasn't one penny, not one nickel, set aside to build an above-ground shelter outside of each of the major cities that would be a permanent place in case there was an emergency from a tornado or hurricane or this kind of thing or fires, where people by at least 50,000 could go and have shelter, food, sanitation, medical care? Nothing was done. Coming in and saying, oh, we're doing a great job, here's FEMA, here's some, you know, food. Now look at Katrina. We learned nothing from Katrina because Sandy came, and that was a Category 1. We learned nothing from Sandy. And now we have this storm, and we've learned nothing from it. But I'll bet you within 3 months, the effort will be, we're going to go back there and rebuild. We're tough. No, that's stupid. And so we have learned nothing from trying to dominate nature with our manifest destiny. We've learned nothing how to cooperate with one another. It's just fall in line, do what you're told. The government and people and corporations know best, and you as individuals, no matter what your station or position, don't have any knowledge of how to handle these. Technology will answer it, and I'm looking and saying, Miami is a mess. New York, when it has a storm, is a mess. Washington, D.C. is a mess. And it's not that these cities are going to be unsustainable in the future. It's just how quickly that future comes, because we're not prepared for any of this, for the very reason that I believe that you are going to take the rest of the program to share with us about. We only look at problems as mechanistic, and we only look at solutions from the same mindset. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, I mean, the situation today, which plays into the hands of those who are in an extreme way advocating separation and exploitation. To my eyes, the whole view which leads to this is what psychologists would call a trauma defense mechanism, which means that if you have experienced something which menaces your whole being, and this might be something external, like a life-threatening accident or a war event, or it might be something internal, like a parent who doesn't really, he was not able to care for your needs as a kid, or a violent situation where somebody is trying to break your will and to enslave you in a way. So these traumatic events, they are all about making you unable to truly be who you are. And if you're unable to truly be who you are, you develop defense mechanisms. And these defense mechanisms are about covering the wound that you feel in your middle, the wound that you can't live what you are meant to live, and then you need to fill this wound with lots of superficially successful and efficient things. And this is what our society is doing. And I'll elaborate on this more. But as you were talking so much about the catastrophes caused by people who are only thinking about themselves and who have this "it's only about me" attitude, that's a clear trauma defense mechanism. If you're absolutely hindered to be what you are in your true heart of being, namely a living being who is able to feel in a vulnerable and sensitive and joyful body and yearning to be connected to other bodies. If you can't do this, then you need to cover this incapacity by building a fake ego, which always works by dominating others. So that's basically a psychological, it's a textbook situation, and it's a textbook situation of trauma research. And to my eyes, our society, for a long time, has been in this mode of trauma defense mechanism, because we have shed our real connection to the source of living, of being alive in this cosmos, and we are not being able as a society and as individuals in this society to get into true connection with this source of being alive, and this leads to all these secondary defense mechanisms. And as I said in when I spoke before you the other time, I think that we should consider the idea that as a whole society we are not on the right page with ourselves. So we are struggling and we are fighting and we are laboring with something about something which is actually not what we really need and what we really yearn for. And what we really yearn for is to be a living being, an organism who needs to be in connection with others. And that's just not what is on the, that's not on the program. That's not something which we even talk about. It's not a topic in school. It's not something openly discussed in society. It's something which is cast away. It's something which is ridiculed even. We talked about science, which is systematically destroying this notion. But still, we are born with this, and we are born with this into a world of other living beings who are able to do this, and who are, because they are able to do this, being removed or being destroyed or being extinguished. And this brings me to what you first said right now before me, when you were starting to say that we should consider that other living beings are not objects and not machines, but subjects. And this is a deep passion of myself, and it's actually a moving force of my work, is to show that we should think of other living beings and of ourselves not as mechanical processes, but as embodied desires to be. And an embodied desire to be is always a subject. It's a center. It's a center of concern to which the world becomes meaning, because if I want to develop and if I want to expand and if I want to prosper and to flourish and to blossom, then everything which happens to me has a meaning to me. And to my eyes, we need to actually, it's kind of simple, because we, on a deep level, we all know. And on a deep level, also the people who had the chance to construct these above ground shelters in the now flooded areas and who didn't, on a deep level, they do connect in a life-giving way to other beings and to other people. It's only that they do this, let's say, in a very private setting, and they do this with their partners and with their kids and with close friends and maybe with their pets and the rest. But the rest is considered as being part of this mechanical, efficient world. So it's a very narrow window on our true life, which we are we're living in a daily way. But to my eyes, in reality, it's much broader, and it's about the whole of our existence, and we're not fulfilling this existence as yearning, vulnerable, and also joyful and lustful subjects, together with other yearning and desireful subjects, which are the plants and the animals. And and to my eyes, this would be a true revolution of thinking, and it would also be a political revolution, because the current state of affairs is based on the assumption that the world is composed of dead building blocks, and some humans somehow have the ability and the ensuing right to rearrange these building blocks. And if we reconsider ourselves as being an organic part of a huge setting of mutual transformations, yearning for more being and for more connection, then we get into a totally different picture. And in my work, I have to try to understand this from a biological and from an experiential and from a psychological and spiritual standpoint. But you could also understand this from a socioeconomic standpoint. You could also understand that if we all are living bodies and parts of a huge exchange within a bigger living body, which is the biosphere, then it's all about sharing, exchange, connection, and mutual transformation. And it's not about separation, and it's not about getting the most for yourself. But to the contrary, it's not about me. It's about making the reality in which I'm a part more prosperous. So the biological revolution or the metaphysical biological revolution I'm after would engender a lot of other consequences, and it would turn the world view which we are having right now on upside down, basically. And still, I love to be detailed and modest, actually, because I'm very much concerned with real other beings, and we can have this experience of being this somebody else who we actually yearn to be. We can have this every day when we connect to other beings, when we connect to plants at the curb, and to animals which cross our way. So we can get into contact with other beings who, to the contrary of us humans, don't have any difficulties in accepting what they are. And that's for me a huge role of the experience of nature for humans. And it's actually a key role that other beings can show us that there is a way of embodied subjectivity in the world which doesn't have a problem with accepting to have needs and with accepting to be in a certain limited way an embodiment of the desire to create endless forms of individuality. And so we are basically, when I started, I said we are living in this trauma defense world where we can't see our true needs, which are the needs of a living being, of being touched and of being in connection and of exchanging what is truly important in this world, namely to grow by giving others the possibility to grow. We do have a remedy, and this is to get into contact with other beings. And it's getting into contact with other humans, but it's also getting into contact with non-human beings, with a more than human world.
Andreas, let me just ask you to give a little more detailed focus on that, because on the one hand, people can relate so easily to that which is non-judgmental to them. A dog, a cat, a bird doesn't care what you look like, what your age is, what your income is. They don't care about your body politics. They're there to love you for their entire lifetime. And so when we, for whatever reason, cannot connect that same exchange of vital life force with another human being, we then can become cynical. We can become disengaging. We no longer trust the vitalism that permeates life itself, because we're more often than not reacting to that which makes us separate. We are now into this whole crazy, stupid, de-evolutionary process of identity politics, where if everyone believes they're right, everyone is self-righteous in their rightness, everyone's willing to go whatever extreme is necessary to prove that self-righteousness. So then in this world today, instead of finding common reason, common joy, that ability to be both tactile and etherical in our relationships, we are we're engaging in duality. Now, specifically, you have known and worked with the famous Chilean neuroscientist Francisco Varela, mm-hmm. who was perhaps the scientist who first developed the theory that there is an inherent ability in organisms, including humans, to self-organize and co-create to achieve harmony. And because this is related to what you explore when you say that every living being, every one of us, every ecosystem, every relationship occurs within a commons that embodies meaning, scientists observe this principle in nature, and it forms one basis of modern ecology. But we don't apply it to ourselves, or certainly we don't organize our culture and act with this understanding, because ultimately it all comes down to love. That's simple, to love. And humanity shows increasingly a critical lack of embracing love. Yet we're all born of love, and then we become altered based upon the relationship epigenetically and otherwise of our caregivers. So love of ourselves and the other. Because how can you kill others if you love them? How can you kill other races? How can you be prejudiced? How can you be a racist? We never ask a racist, why are you racist? Why do you hate other cultures? Why do you hate women if you're a misogynist? Why do you believe that other people should be considered inferior beings? Why do you believe you should have rules that apply to women or other cultures or other races, but not to you? You are willing to allow a woman's clitoris to be cut off so she cannot experience sexual pleasure, but you would never consider having your sexual organs cut off. Why do you believe this? And we won't go there. We won't try to engage to find out the progenitor, where this evolved from. We simply look at the end stage, the final symptom, and then we give it a synonym, and then we, after labeling it, we then say we're against it. Fine, be against it. But at some point, if you've ever read The Art of War, you better understand that the way you help change the outcome of a war is understand what is the motivating factors in those that you oppose. And we don't care what a person's belief is or how they evolved or where they got to where they're at. And if possible, could we help change that? Could we give people the tools needed to change to a more spiritual and humane and loving so they could re-embrace love so we wouldn't see each other as the other? We wouldn't denigrate. We wouldn't fight. We wouldn't be saying, you have no right to free speech and you have no right to march and you have no right. We can be in absolute contempt of what a person stands for. But understand, the moment we say you have no right to speak, then that can come back at us and ultimately will. And almost every society that has been fascistic has used that same principle. They go after the three free thinkers. They go after those that are considered progressives in their society. So talk about, if you would please, and we have about 12 minutes for you to do this, loving ourselves so we can then understand how to love others. Because if you can't love yourself, you're sure as hell not going to love anyone else. And we don't even recognize that love might have a biological or even an ecological basis, a self-organizing basis. We can observe love in the ecologies of other species and animals if we look hard enough. So is there any way to understand love ecologically as part of what it means to be a human being? And finally, explain what you mean when I heard you earlier talk about a human commons and how love evolves and is enacted from this common, since everything today is being privatized. We're trying to eliminate the commons. We're trying to eliminate that which holds us together, society. And now we're actually smart enough, the oligarchs, the fascists, those, the neoliberal hierarchy is smart enough to get people fighting each other. You know, isn't it rather ironic? Think of this for a moment. People protesting the people who supported a civil war and slavery, and now out of their anger towards these people are creating another form of a civil war. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, thanks that you mention, that you bring up the word love, and you asked me to elaborate on this because it's a very important part of my thinking. And so it's important to see that that I'm not considering love as what many people do, as a human feeling towards other humans, but I consider it as a practice of being, and it's a practice of being which enables you to be yourself through enabling the other to be herself or himself, and this is a deep ecological principle. And it's an ecological principle, but how I put it right now here, it's also a principle of a fruitful relationship. Imagine a relationship, and imagine that you can enjoy yourself through the flourishing your partner or your kid or whoever you're relating to is enjoying. That gives immediately a good intuition about that's somehow how it is. The other flourishes, and this makes me happy. So that would be a good relationship. But so that's a first person experience in our human world. But if you look at ecosystems, or if you look at bodies in connection with the world, you can see the same principle. So an ecosystem works because the beings implied in this ecosystem can only be themselves by a massive exchange with all the other beings in the ecosystem. And that's something which mainstream science doesn't really pay attention to, because it's always stressing the fact that, and which isn't even totally provable, and it's even, let's say, very hotly debated in actual biology, the fact that there's always competition between every individual implied in ecosystems. But if you look at a deeper level, you see that to prosper for a being in an ecosystem, it is dependent on the presence of so many other beings who provide food and who provide shelter and to provide, let's say, the global infrastructure of its own flourishing. So an ecosystem is a total mutuality. It's a process of mutual creation, of co-creation. And my teacher Varela, who you already referred to, said, put this into the nice phrase that the bee dreams the flower and the flower imagines the bee. So we can't imagine flowering plants without the insects who started to pollinate them. It's a mutual story. It's a co-creating story. And so we could say that in a very poetic way, we could say that it's a love story between two lineages, and one is vegetal and the other is animal. And in the course of history, this gave rise to the variety of flowering plants and the variety of pollinating insects, which is a love story in the sense that one only comes to be through the other. Without flowering plants, no pollinating insects, and vice versa. So to my eyes, we need to see in the living world or in reality a profound principle of reciprocity, which means that I can only come to be through the other who through me comes to be. And this is a principle of reciprocity, which is a, let's say, a deep functional principle, but it is also a principle which we can experience. And this is the great thing, actually, about being an embodied organism. It's that we follow certain principles, but on the other hand, we can feel them in our senses, and we can feel them in our souls and in our hearts. And as we are a part of the larger ecosystem, it absolutely makes sense that we feel them in our interiority, because we need to feel them to be part of this larger ecosystem. And that's the wisdom and the knowledge which our culture totally forsakes, but which is there, and without which we will never be able to grasp the true expanse of the larger commons of mutuality we are in. And so we do have a very concrete biological base for this thought. And on the other hand, we do have a very personal, first-person experience to this same motive.
Andreas, we're out of time. This conversation will be continued on another program. We have much more to discuss, but we're out of time now. My guest from Berlin, Germany, one of the great biologist philosophers on the planet, Dr. Andreas Weber, but it's actually pronounced Weber in German, and his website is biologyofwonder.org, and he is doing new work on matter and desire, similar to Rachel Carson. We will invite him back. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate.